Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Frances Alonso reporting. President Barack Obama says the U.S. and France stand united to deliver justice to terrorists after the recent Paris attacks claimed by the Islamic State. Speaking after talks with his French counterpart, François Hollande, at the White House, President Obama said IS cannot be tolerated, must be destroyed, and we must do it together.
Building on our recent intelligence agreement, the United States will continue to quickly share threat information with France. And in the wake of Paris and with the threats in Belgium, there's also a growing recognition among European nations that they need to ramp up additional efforts to prevent the flow of foreign terrorist fighters.
President Hollande was at the White House Tuesday, a day after meeting with British Prime Minister David Cameron, who pledged France new assistance for airstrikes against the Islamic State militants in Syria. An explosion hit a bus carrying members of Tunisia's presidential guard in the country's capital Tuesday, killing at least 11 people, according to the Interior Ministry. The blast occurred on a tree-lined avenue in the center of the capital of Tunis. The explosion came about 10 days after authorities increased the security level in the capital and deployed security forces in unusually high numbers. The Islamic State's Egyptian branch claimed responsibility for a bombing that killed 7 people in a hotel in the North Sinai capital, Al-Arish, on Tuesday, where judges overseeing a parliamentary election were staying. The statement by the Sinai Province group was circulated by its supporters on Twitter and the encrypted messaging system Telegram. A militant tried to drive a car bomb into the hotel before security forces opened fire on him, causing the car to explode, according to the military. VOA News. A teenager has died in Liberia from Ebola, and the first such death since the country was officially declared free of the virus in September, according to officials Tuesday. The 15-year-old boy died on Monday, according to Dr. Francis Carte. He is the head of Liberia's National Ebola Crisis Unit. He added that the teenager's parents had also tested positive for the virus and were under observation in Monrovia. The official leading the investigation into the attack on a luxury hotel in Mali's capital is urging residents to keep an eye out for suspicious behavior and warns of heightened security threats. The prosecutor of the country Tuesday provided scarce new information about the investigation of Friday's assault that killed 19 people. The Turkish prime minister has strongly defended the shooting down of a Russian fighter jet. Ankara says the jet violated Turkish airspace while carrying out attacks against Syrian targets. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
Turkish Prime Minister Ahmet Davutoğlu robustly defended the downing by two of its fighter jets of a Russian bomber that Ankara claims was violating its airspace.
Sınırlarımızın güvenliği söz konusu olduğunda, ülkemizin bu ateş çemberi içinde...
He says the entire world should be aware and sure that we will do whatever necessary in order to ensure our country's peace and security within all this ring of fire, in order to maintain peace in Turkey. Davutoğlu went on to warn any country that carries out attacks against Syrian groups, including Kurds, Arabs or Turkmen, that Turkey's message would be clear. Dorian Jones of VOA News, Istanbul.
Secretary of State John Kerry has condemned the recent wave of Palestinian attacks as he meets with the Israeli and Palestinian officials as he headed into talks with the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu Tuesday.
It is very clear to us that the terrorism, these acts of terrorism which have been taking place, deserve the condemnation that they are receiving. And today I express my complete condemnation for any act of terror that takes innocent lives and disrupts the day-to-day life of a nation.
Meanwhile, Netanyahu said there could be no peace when there was an onslaught of terror. The State Department says the two men discussed steps that could be taken to stop the violence and strengthen security cooperation. Egypt's Antiquities Ministry says archaeologists have found a giant fence at the site of an ancient capital city in the northern Nile Delta region. It dates back to 3,500 years. It says it's at least 500 meters long and 7 meters thick. I'm Frances Alonso in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Ihis Wuhib. And coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
It's been noted that the terrorists did not direct their attacks against the French government or military. Rather, they focused their violence on the very spirit of France, and by extension, on all liberal democracies.
That was President Obama speaking today after his meeting with French President Hollande. Details next.
Also, Belgium's prime minister says the capital will be on the highest state of alert until at least next week. And Burundi's government has suspended 10 civil society groups, accusing them of fueling violence that has left more than 200 people dead since April.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Gabon, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on African News Tonight.
President Obama met with French President Hollande at the White House today in the wake of the recent terrorist attacks in Paris. Mr. Obama expressed American solidarity with the French people. The president said the attacks were aimed at people who live in free and open societies.
It's been noted that the terrorists did not direct their attacks against the French government or military. Rather, they focused their violence on the very spirit of France, and by extension, on all liberal democracies. This was an attack on our free and open societies, where people come together to celebrate and sing and compete, and targeting venues where people come together from around the world, killing citizens of nearly 20 countries, including America. This was an attack on the very idea that people of different races and religions and backgrounds can live together in peace. In short, this was not only a strike against one of the world's great cities. It was an attack against the world itself. It's the same madness that has slaughtered the innocent from Nigeria to the Sinai, from Lebanon to Iraq. It is a scourge that threatens all of us. And that's why, for more than a year, the United States, France, and our coalition of some 65 nations have been united in one mission: to destroy these ISIL terrorists and defeat their vile ideology.
The president said the U.S.-led coalition has launched over 8,000 strikes against the Islamic State.
Today, President Hollande and I agreed that our nations must do even more together. U.S. assistance has supported recent French strikes in Syria, and we're going to keep stepping up that coordination. And as we saw with the attack in Mali, the terrorist threat goes beyond ISIL. This week, I'll sign legislation to sustain our support, including airlift and intelligence, to allies like France as we work together to root out terrorist networks in Africa. We'll do even more to prevent attacks at home. Building on our recent intelligence agreement, the United States will continue to quickly share threat information with France. And in the wake of Paris and with the threats in Belgium, there's also a growing recognition among European nations that they need to ramp up additional efforts to prevent the flow of foreign terrorist fighters. As part of that, I'm calling on the European Union to finally implement the agreement that's been long in the works that would require airlines to share passenger information, so we can do more to stop foreign terrorist fighters from entering our countries undetected. And I am prepared to send teams of our experts to work on this with our European partners to make sure we're redoubling our efforts together.
President Obama speaking today at the White House following his meeting with French President Hollande.
Schools and the subway system remained closed today as Brussels remained under tight security. Authorities are searching for the key suspect in the November 13 Paris terrorist attacks. Belgium's Prime Minister Charles Michel says the capital will be on the highest state of alert until at least next week. But he said students would go back to school tomorrow and the trains in Brussels would be running. Meanwhile, Moroccan authorities say Belgium has asked for close and intense cooperation in tracking Paris suspect Salah Abdel Salam. He avoided arrest since crossing into Belgium hours after the Paris attacks that killed 130 people. A Moroccan tip helped lead French police to an apartment in North Paris where another suspect, massacre architect Abdelhamid Abaoud, was killed in a November 18th raid. Elsewhere, police are analyzing an apparent suicide explosive belt found in a trash bin in a southern Paris suburb.
Meanwhile, in Egypt, Islamic State militants claimed responsibility today for killing a judge, two policemen, and a civilian in a suicide bombing at a hotel in the northern Sinai Peninsula. Cairo says the assault wounded 12 other people. The attack occurred at the Swiss Inn in El Arish, where judges overseeing the country's parliamentary elections were staying. The military says troops and policemen opened fire on an explosives-laden car as it approached the hotel, blowing it up. But it says two militants slipped into the hotel. One detonated an explosives vest in the kitchen while the other opened fire inside a hotel room.
Egypt says three attackers were killed in the incident, but Islamic State says only two of its fighters carried out the assault. Meanwhile, in Niger, one of Africa's top fashion events, FIMA, was cancelled today over fears of terror attacks. The French news agency says Niger's government made the decision. About 1,000 people from 40 countries had planned to attend FIMA, which was due to begin tomorrow.
Malian authorities have asked the public for help in identifying two gunmen killed in a terrorist attack on a Bamako hotel on Friday. That's because there are conflicting claims of responsibility from multiple jihadist groups in Mali. Authorities say 21 people were killed in the attack, while nearly 140 staff and guests from more than 20 countries were evacuated safely. Katerina Hoya has the latest on the investigation from Bamako.
4 days after the attack on the Radisson Blue Hotel in Bamako, the details remain unclear. Malian authorities say gunmen stormed the hotel early Friday, yelling Allahu Akbar, God is great, in Arabic. Some of the people killed were in the breakfast room, but there were also victims on the two uppermost floors. Some survivors said the attacker spoke French. One hotel guest said they knocked on his door, claiming to be hotel security. There were at least two attackers, but as many as 10 by some reports. The count of survivors suggests there were four or five gunmen. Amadou Sango of Ministry for Security and Civil Protection says investigators are working to identify the two gunmen whose bodies were found at the scene.
The two terrorists ont fait un appel à témoins pour demander aux populations si toutefois.
He says more than one group has claimed responsibility, but he will not speculate about which group committed the attack. Sango says when the gunmen are identified, investigators might also be able to determine which group executed the attack. The first jihadist group to take responsibility for the attack has identified two gunmen, Abdel Hakim al-Ansari and Mouad al-Ansari. Sango could not confirm those were the men in the photos released by authorities. That group, Al-Murabitun, or the Sentinels, released a tweet as the seven-hour siege was ending Friday and then an audio message to a Mauritanian news site Monday. Al-Murabitun is a fusion of two Al-Qaeda-linked groups in northern Mali. The group is believed to still be led by long-time Algerian jihadist Mokhtar Belmokhtar. Belmokhtar masterminded the 2012 attack on a gas plant in In Amenas that killed at least 67 people, many of them foreigners. But another jihadist group called the Messina Liberation Front, active primarily in central Mali, said Sunday in a statement to French media that there were five gunmen at the Radisson and three of them escaped. The MLF claimed the attack as a joint operation with Ansadin, another Malian jihadist movement in the north. The MLF attacked a hotel in the central Malian town of Sévre in August, holding staff and guests hostage and killing 13 people. The contradictory claims of responsibility for the Bamako attack could suggest a power struggle among jihadist groups operating in Mali. New groups have formed as others have fractured. Membership has at times overlapped. The confusion underscores the security challenges Mali faces now almost 3 years after the start of an international military intervention in the north. Katerina Hayek for VOA News, Bamako.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yusuf Heeb. Here is a recap of our top stories. President Obama met with French President Hollande at the White House today in the wake of the recent terrorist attacks in Paris. And Malian authorities have asked the public for help in identifying two gunmen killed in the terrorist attack on a Bamako hotel Friday. And would like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
Pope Francis arrives in Uganda late Friday. Uganda has one of the largest Catholic communities in Africa. The highlight of the Pope's visit will be the 50th anniversary celebration of the canonization of 22 Ugandan martyrs. Sergino Rusblad reports from Kampala.
Workers are putting the finishing touches on the preparations of the Namugongo Shrine in Kampala. As many as 2 million people are expected here Saturday for a mass with Pope Francis. This is one of Africa's most important Catholic shrines, says Director Reverend Vincent Lubega. Thousands of pilgrims walk here every June to pay tribute.
So Namugongo is important and the center of all the martyrdom because the head of the group was martyred here.
In 1886, 22 Catholic converts were killed by the Bugandan king for their refusal to renounce Christianity. In 1964, Pope John Paul VI canonized the group. And now, half a century later, the leader of the Roman Catholic Church will mark the occasion.
He will come over through that door, kneel here before the relics, and say a prayer in silence.
40% of Ugandans are Catholic, one of the largest communities in Africa. Church members outside Rubaga Cathedral, the oldest church in Uganda, say the visit is a blessing. This is Uganda's third papal visit. The previous two were in 1969 and 1993.
We are very happy that the Pope is coming. This is a long time since the other Pope was here.
The excitement is palpable and good for business, say street vendors.
We are selling T-shirts with the Pope, an emblem, badges, the Vatican flag, the umbrella, all of them, including the photo of the Pope.
The Archbishop of Gulu, John Baptiste Odama, says the Pope's timing is good as Uganda is heading to what are expected to be particularly contentious elections in early 2016.
His coming has rallied us all together, the government, the church, and the population at large.
Church leaders cannot say what exactly the Pope will discuss in Uganda, but global inequality has become one of his signature issues.
What does he normally do? In many other countries, he talks about the rights of the poor. The sick should not be neglected. They should be supported by the governments.
Ugandans say they eagerly await the Pope's message. Serginho Rosblat for VOA News, Kampala.
In related news, an international human rights organization says Pope Francis' visit to Kenya, Uganda, and the Central African Republic will be a key moment to stand with victims of abuses. Human Rights Watch is calling on the Pope to speak out strongly on matters of justice, civil and political rights, religious tolerance, and respect for sexual and gender minorities. Annika van Woudenberg is a spokesperson for Human Rights Watch. From London, she explains why the Pope's visit could help alleviate the suffering of those whose rights are being violated.
Well, it's certainly a historic trip for Pope Francis. It's his first time coming to Africa as Pope, and apparently his first visit to Africa ever. And of course, Africa is enthralled by this Pope, much like other parts of the world. I think there will be a lot of eyes and ears on the Pope over the coming days, and what he says about some of the key issues facing Africa is going to be closely followed and paid attention to.
And one of those big issues is human rights abuses that are taking place, for instance, in the Central African Republic. So how do you think he is going to address this issue of human rights abuses?
Well, this, of course, is going to be hopefully a critical part of his mission. He is going to three countries which have gone through significant human rights abuses in recent years, and the Central African Republic still in the middle of it. He'll start his visit in Kenya and then on to Uganda. And both those two countries, of course, have had historical violence, especially around the time of elections. And in those two countries, still a lack of justice for much of the violence that has taken place, including including in Kenya, the terrible violence that occurred during the 2007-2008 electoral crisis, where over 1,000 people died and 650,000 were displaced. There's still no real justice for that. Same in Uganda, where he will be going, where there has also been significant human rights abuses by Ugandan security forces, both in their fight against a rebel group known as the Lord's Resistance Army, but also more recently against political opponents. No justice for any of that. And then, of course, in the Central African Republic, which is in the middle of an ongoing sectarian crisis, with people still dying on a regular basis across the country, in particular in the capital, Bangui. And so I think what the Pope will say about justice and accountability is going to be really important. And in the past, the Vatican has talked about the need for justice to build peaceful solutions to problems and how important justice is for peace. And we very much hope the Pope will reiterate that message in all three of the countries he's going to be visiting.
Do you think the leaders of the countries will also put into place measures that will help alleviate some of the suffering of the people who are experiencing these abuses?
Certainly, there have been steps taken in the Central African Republic to put in place some mechanisms to try to bring justice. Those are in the very early stages, and to date, we haven't seen anyone being held to account for it yet. In Kenya and Uganda, the government has largely ignored questions of justice for these significant abuses that have taken place. And it will be interesting to see if the Pope makes comments about that, and specifically if he addresses that in his meetings with the various heads of state. You know, it's of course not the only question of human rights abuses that the Pope will be facing in all the countries that he will visit. You know, in two of the countries, Uganda and the Central African Republic, they're about to head into elections. And especially in Uganda, we've seen crackdowns already on free speech, on peaceful assembly, on the possibility for the opposition to organize, you know, a problem that is in fact hitting us across Africa. And here the Pope will be visiting a country where it is quite evident and where they're in the middle of a presidential election campaign.
Another expectation is the Pope speaking on religious tolerance and also tolerance for those of sexual and gender minorities.
The sexual and gender minorities is, of course, an issue across Africa. We have seen continued widespread violence against individuals of sexual and gender minorities. Certainly at Human Rights Watch, we don't expect that the Vatican is going to see eye to eye with us on everything in relation to the rights of the LGBT community. But this is a moment for the Pope to reiterate a message he has said in a number of other environments of stopping violence against people of sexual and gender minorities and indeed condemning that violence. It will be important for the Pope to really reiterate the stance that he has said on occasion of not condoning this violence, of very much condemning it and showing tolerance for people of sexual and gender minorities. The same would go, we would say, at Human Rights Watch for those of ethnic minorities, particularly in Kenya, where individuals of Somali origin have been targeted in recent waves of violence, and of course in the Central African Republic, of people of the Muslim religion. And that should be really the strong message of tolerance and to stop discrimination. I very much hope it's going to be a key part of what the Pope will say.
That was Annika van Woudenberg, a spokesperson for Human Rights Watch. She spoke with me from London.
The Paris Climate Conference, known as COP21, opens November 30th. The goal is to reach a binding universal agreement on climate change, something 20 years of negotiations have failed to do so far. A new analysis says many countries agree the improvements in agriculture are necessary to ease the effects of rising global temperatures. VOA's Jody Capua reports.
The study says many countries have what it calls a huge appetite for technical assistance and financing for adaptation and mitigation strategies related to agriculture. The analysis of country-level climate plans was done by CGIAR, a global research agricultural partnership. Dr. Bruce Campbell is director of the organization's program for climate change, agriculture, and food security. He says the Paris summit is crucial.
Oh, goodness, this climate conference is probably one of the most important ones because it's really going to set agreement for the next decades.
Since climate talks have failed so many times before, Campbell lays out what needs to be done to reach an agreement.
I think that what we have to see is countries committing to sufficient actions to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and also sufficient finance to make sure adaptation happens, because we're already on a course for a warmer and changed climate, so we need to put in place adaptation as well as mitigation.
CGIAR says of the 160 parties participating in COP21, 80% have included agriculture in climate change mitigation targets or actions. At the same time, 64% say agriculture is important in climate adaptation strategies. Campbell says countries have made it clear that agriculture is a priority. Nevertheless, the study states that agriculture as a sector remains absent from the main draft text of the official UN climate negotiations. It describes that as a major disconnect between national-level planning and global-level policymaking.
Hopefully, the international commitment agrees that the national commitments are sufficient to deal with the climate problem. And so those national commitments will then become part of the international agreement.
But Campbell says it will be exceptionally challenging for developing countries to put in place both mitigation and adaptation strategies. He gives the example of rice farming.
Paddy rice emits large amounts of greenhouse gases, methane. If you change the production method, you can reduce greenhouse gases in paddy rice down to 30 to 50%, but it doesn't increase your yields. You have to put in extra effort to reduce the emissions, but you don't gain a lot out of it.
Therefore, developing countries may need financial help to make those changes, which include new methods to reduce water usage. Campbell says changes in livestock production in developing countries would also help. Overall, livestock contributes up to 55% of agricultural greenhouse gas emissions.
So, for example, in dairy farming, if we think of Africa, there's a rise in milk consumption in towns. If you improve the feed to the livestock, you do many things at the same time. First of all, you improve the amount of milk you get per animal, you increase the farmer's income, and you reduce the greenhouse gas emissions per unit of milk produced.
The International Livestock Research Institute and the World Agroforestry Center are testing measures to improve livestock feed for smallholder farms. CGIAR also recommends combining modern and traditional methods for making climate forecasts and sending that information to smallholder farmers by mobile phones and radio broadcasts. But Campbell adds, the question is, where will the support to implement those plans come from? He says so far, there has been exceptionally slow progress on these issues. The Paris Climate Conference runs from November 30th through December 11th. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Next on Straight Talk Africa, Pope Francis travels to Africa. Making his first trip to the continent, the pontiff will visit Kenya, Uganda, and the Central African Republic in a pilgrimage that will bring him face to face with Islamic extremism and Christian-Muslim violence. Join host Shaka Sali and his guests as they discuss the significance of the Pope's mission next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC on VOA Africa.
When news is happening, VOA Africa is there.
Mohamed Yusuf of VOA News, Nairobi.
Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Joba.
Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Yaoundé.
VOA correspondents take you right to the center of events as they're happening. And this is where you hear it all on VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Belgium's prime minister says the capital will be on the highest state of alert until at least next week. Malian authorities have asked the public for help in identifying two gunmen killed in the terrorist attack on a Bamako hotel on Friday. And Burundi's government suspends 10 civil society groups, accusing them of fueling violence that has left more than 200 people dead since April. Coming up, we'll have music from Gabon, and in our feature segment, in Zimbabwe, hunger forces the majority of school-aged children to drop out of school. I'm Kim Lewis with Yeheya Swuhi. Bands, we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Happy Tuesday, Sunny.
Happy Tuesday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you are starting off with Major League Soccer.
Kim, let's kick off with an update on the Major League Soccer playoffs. Four clubs remain in contention for the trophy, which will be awarded December 6th when the MLS Cup title game is played. In the Eastern Conference final, the Columbus Crew lead the New York Red Bulls 2-0. The decisive second leg will be played November 29th at Red Bull Arena near New York City. And in the Western Conference final, the Portland Timbers lead FC Dallas 3-1. The decisive second leg in that home and away series will also be played Sunday, November 29th at Toyota Stadium in Texas. In action this past Sunday, striker Kai Kamara, who is from Sierra Leone, scored Columbus's second goal in that 2-0 victory over New York. The 31-year-old Kamara is enjoying his best season ever in Major League Soccer. He and Italian striker Sebastian Giovinco of Toronto FC tied for the MLS scoring title with 22 goals each. The 28-year-old Giovinco joined Toronto in January from the Italian club Juventus, and he was named Major League Soccer's Newcomer of the Year. The Big League Award, Most Valuable Player, will be announced on December 2nd. Getting back to Kai Kamara, in addition to that league scoring title, he won the MLS Humanitarian of the Year Award, given to the player who exemplifies both skill on the field and service within the community. Taking a look at some of the other MLS end-of-season awards, Liberia-born Darlington Nagbe of the Portland Timbers, who recently became a U.S. citizen, won the MLS Fair Player Award. That award is given to the player who exemplifies sportsmanlike behavior, in addition to receiving one of the lowest number of yellow and red cards, fouls, and disciplinary violations. And while Kamara and Giovinco each scored 22 goals during the regular season, Giovinco won the MLS Golden Boot Award as top scorer because he had more assists than Kamara. More MLS award winners, Belgian player Laurent Simon of the Montreal Impact was named the MLS Defender of the Year. Luis Robles of the New York Red Bulls was named the MLS Goalkeeper of the Year. And Kyle Larin of the Florida club Orlando City was named the MLS Rookie of the Year. And speaking of awards, let's take a short break now for this important message from a Congolese giant who was inducted into the Basketball Hall of Fame in September.
This is Dikembe Mutombo. I am from Africa. Malaria kills thousands of children every day. Don't let your child be one of them. Make sure they sleep under a treated mosquito net. Beating malaria is like winning at basketball. You need to get to the net.
Basketball. In National Basketball Association news, LeBron James of the Cleveland Cavaliers joined some very exclusive company on Monday night in Ohio. LeBron scored 15 points and had 13 assists to help the Cavaliers remain unbeaten at home this season with a 117-103 win over the Orlando Magic. In the process, LeBron joined Oscar Robertson as the only players in NBA history to rank in the top 25 in career points and assists. The Big O, Oscar Robertson, finished his Hall of Fame career with 26,710 points and 9,887 assists. So yeah, LeBron and the Big O, some very exclusive company. Elsewhere, Kevin Durant made a triumphant return from a hamstring injury. Durant scored 27 points and grabbed 6 rebounds to help the Oklahoma City Thunder beat the host Utah Jazz 111-89. It was Durant's first game for the Thunder since he got hurt November 10th right here in Washington, his birthplace. In Monday night's 5 other NBA games, the Miami Heat beat the New York Knicks 95-78 to snap New York's 4-game winning streak. The Charlotte Hornets defeated the Sacramento Kings 127-122 in overtime. Kemba Walker had 39 points for the Hornets. The 5-time NBA champion San Antonio Spurs defeated the visiting Phoenix Suns 98-84. The Minnesota Timberwolves topped the Philadelphia 76ers 100-95. Philadelphia is off to a horrible start this season. They've lost their first 15 games. And in one more NBA result, the Milwaukee Bucks beat the Detroit Pistons 109-88.
The Voice of America, VOA.
It's time to climb between the ropes once again with the VOA's undisputed and reigning prince of pugilistics, Nnamdi Hollywood Moeta. Good evening, Nnamdi.
And a good evening, Sonny.
Nnamdi, the Mexican star Canelo defeats Miguel Cotto over the weekend to win the vacant WBC middleweight title. You were ringside at the Mandalay Bay Hotel and Casino Events Center in Las Vegas, Nnamdi. First off, let's go to the scorecards and get your reaction. Unanimous decision for Canelo, 117-111, 119-109, and 118-110. Fair decision, Nnamdi?
All in favor of Canelo. A little bit wide. It could have been a little closer because some people felt the fight could have been a draw. And some people felt it should have been a little closer. But check this out. Some people felt, too, he should have paid that $300,000 by WBC and he would have been a little closer. You
and
know?
Then maybe the decision would look different.
Yeah, should have paid the $300,000 they demanded, you know.
So you're saying the judges could have been influenced by the WBC decision?
Yeah, because the president of the WBC, Mauricio Suleiman, was ringside, you know. And then he's the one that signs the checks for the judges, you know. I mean, come on, man, you know. You're fighting a Mexican, and the president of the WBC is a Mexican, and he's in the room. You better know what you're doing, or you're not going to get the next assignment. You know?
Nnamdi, I watched the fight, and I sort of agree with this one observer who said it looked like a natural middleweight in his prime, Canelo, beating an aging welterweight just past his prime, Cotto. Your thoughts?
Yes, at the age of 25, Canelo is still growing. And going into this fight, we talked about he may have been able to cut off the ring and use his legs and push back Cotto. Cotto was unable to hurt Canelo. You could see Canelo was a prime middleweight, though he claims he's not 160 yet. So, but Cotto just hadn't, he didn't have the impact, you know, because pressure was on Cotto. He kept backing up all night.
So you're saying Canelo was never hurt by anything that Cotto threw?
No. Canelo had airtight defense plus his fast hands, and he was able to even look at the fight, look at his footwork. He kind of reminded me of Muhammad Ali's footwork, you know. You're looking at a fighter that's ready to fight, fan-friendly style, all action. He's got power in both hands, you know.
Nnamdi, you talk about that fan-friendly style of Canelo. Were the fans rooting for Canelo, or were they split in terms of the cheers?
It was a little bit, more like a 60-40 split right there, because the Mexicans, they come out and they like action, you know. And their man was just delivering action, and the blows were just like the body shots, the movement, the jabs. He was delivering, and everybody were on their feet, you know. I mean, look back, 6 months ago, millions of people opened their wallet only to feel cheated by this fight of the century, fight of the century, you know, Manny Pacquiao and Floyd Mayweather. But for this fight to end the year with all action, nobody complained. There was no knockdown, but, you know, we had a great time.
Namdi, as you told our VOA boxing fans last week, the WBC stripped Cotto of his WBC title for not paying sanctioning fees. Now the belt goes to Canelo. What's next for Canelo in terms of WBC requirements?
Well, Sonny, when they made a deal, there was a stipulation that allowed the fight Saturday night to happen. It was that the winner must begin negotiations with Triple G in 15 days. Because Triple G, mind you, is a WBA and IBF champion, but he's a WBC number one mandatory fighter. So will Canelo and Oscar De La Hoya start negotiating with Triple G? We will see.
How do you see that fight, Namdi, Triple G against Canelo?
I've always believed that Triple G is all hype, Sonny. Triple G have not really fought anybody, you know. I mean, Triple G with Canelo is going to be huge because the Mexican fans, they love Canelo. It's their number one guy. It's going to be a great fight. The kind of fight is a fight that will go into the Los Angeles Coliseum or the Cowboy Stadium in Dallas. That fight is enough to draw 100,000 people. But in a big fight like that, we have to negotiate. We have to look at pay-per-view numbers, Sonny. The last Triple G fight was 150,000.
Thanks, Namdi. That's our reigning prince of pugilistics, Namdi Hollywood Moueta. And we'll hear more verbal jabs from Namdi later this week. If you tuned into Monday's Sunny Side of Sports, you heard me report on Haile Gebrselassie's symbolic farewell race, the Great Ethiopian Run on Sunday in Addis Ababa. I posted a photo of Haile at my Facebook page. The address is facebook.com/VOA Sunny. George Otieno in Nairobi, Kenya, saw the Haile photo, and George wrote, "Go for it, Great Haile." Afolabi Ayo, no address given, wrote, "Great runner. Everything and everyone has an ending, Haile. Athletics will never forget you." And I echo those words by Afolabi Ayo. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yahias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Okay, thank you, Sonny. And listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up in Zimbabwe, hunger forces the majority of school-age children to drop out of school. And next, women rights activists in South Sudan want more women appointed to ministerial positions. But first, some music. Here is Oliver Ngoma from Gabon with Mouwe.
Kalina. chapati.
Gabon's Oliver Ngoma with Maye.
Well, the Zimbabwe Ministry of Education recently reported an alarming number of school dropouts in the country as parents struggle with school fees. But in remote Binga Matabeleland North, parents say it's not only about school fees, it's also about hunger that has forced the majority of school-aged children to drop out of school. Patricia Mudadigwa of VOA's Zimbabwe Service reports.
Speaking in Mchesu, which is about 80 kilometers from Binga town, parents say the current drought that the area is experiencing has forced their children to stay at home. Poverty is written all over the area, with many parents lamenting their situation. They are all looking up to the skies, hoping the heavens will break and bring them the much-needed rains. Aida Sibanda, who has two school-going children, we had to travel about 7 kilometers to get to school, said she was forced to stop them from attending classes at Mcheso Primary School as they had no energy to walk back and forth and participate in classes.
Yeah, at Binga, we've got a big problem of drought. We don't have food. Children are not going to school just because of hunger. So the causes of hunger is that last year rain was not many. So the sun heated the crops, so we didn't manage to get more food for supporting our children.
Another villager, Mrs. Mulea, told Studio 7 that because of their desperate situation, they are appealing to humanitarian organizations who hardly assist this area to intervene and save their lives.
There was a shortage of rainfall. This causes the crops to die. So children, they are not going to school because of hunger. So we are asking for help so that children will go to school to learn.
Nyoni Mwembe told Studio 7 that besides the shortage of food, sources of water drying up in the area, with villagers being forced to share the few sources of water with their animals. Most are traveling long distances to fetch water. According to a report published in July 2015 by the Zimbabwe Vulnerability Assessment Committee, some 1.5 million, 16% of the rural population, who have insufficient means to meet their minimum food needs during the 2015-2016 lean season. It is highly unlikely that the cash-strapped Harare will be able to feed all hungry Zimbabweans as he had been promised earlier in the year. Most rural communities in the country are looking up to non-governmental organizations for food aid. Reporting in Binga, this is Patricia Mdadigwa.
Women rights activists in South Sudan want more women appointed to ministerial positions in the expected transitional government of national unity. The agreement states that 9 female ministers should be appointed to the transitional government. Activists say this quota is lower than the 25% policy for women representation in all government institutions, which is already required by the transitional constitution. Philip Tonaliu reports from Juba.
Nyanton, Jamie's host, presented a paper on the role of women in peace building during a public lecture organized by the SAD Institute. She says women played a key role during the peace talks and must be actively involved in the peace deal. Host says the agreement specifies the number of women to be appointed to the national government, but says nothing about how many women should be appointed to state governments.
It's very important that all the IO and the government and the other political party to observe the 25% within their representations, make sure that women are involved in all the activities.
Who says military commanders are not the only ones who should be given prominent positions in the transitional government of national unity.
Women doesn't have to be at the front line to fight, but women are key stakeholders within the conflict. Women take different roles. Definitely, there are women that we can say that they're actually on the front line.
Women activist Margaret Matiang agrees. She says the transitional government will have 9 female ministers, including 4 to be nominated by the government and 3 by the SPLM-IO. She points out that that number is lower than the 25% female representation in all government institutions as provided for in 2011 transitional constitution.
When a South Sudanese woman sees a woman in a position of decision-making, she always feels proud that she's represented, and she can easily bring her issues to, reach out to that person who is in that responsibility so that her views can be heard.
Matiang says the role of women will be particularly important for peace building in a post-conflict South Sudan.
When people started fighting, many women thought this is the war between, the elephants. But the people who suffered most are who? Women and children. So peace is a public demand, especially for women and children.
Agulde Chut, another women rights activist attending the lecture, says women should not limit their scope to political participation. Chut says the peace agreement is an opportunity to address issues affecting women in villages. Chut says women groups must expand their outreach and fight cultural norms that prevent girls from going to school, such as early child marriages. For VOA News, I am Philip Tonaleu in Juba.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Ruhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Linus Rimkus, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States condemns terrorist attacks on Tuesday, November 17th and Wednesday, November 18th that reportedly killed more than 40 innocent people in Nigeria. U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, expressed her condolences to the families of the victims, noting that joint efforts to counter Boko Haram continue. 15 people were reportedly killed and several dozens injured in the northern city of Kano when two girls, said to be aged 11 and 18, detonated bombs, killing themselves and bystanders in a busy mobile phone market. News reports note that the use of conscripted young women and children is a hallmark of the terrorist group Boko Haram. The apparent use of children, particularly young girls, to commit these attacks is especially heinous, said U.S. Department of State spokesman John Kirby in a statement in October. It provides yet more examples of the horrific measures Boko Haram is willing to take to terrorize civilians in northeast Nigeria and the Lake Chad Basin region. These attacks followed an explosion the day before at a market in Yola that reportedly killed at least 32 and wounded 80. Boko Haram is believed to be behind both attacks. The group was named the world's deadliest extremist group in the Global Terrorism Index, a list recently published by the Institute for Economics and Peace. Boko Haram also pledged allegiance to the Islamic State, or Daesh, in March. The last suspected Boko Haram attacks in Nigeria were on October 23rd, when reportedly more than 30 people were killed in bombings in Yola and in Maiduguri. U.S. President Barack Obama ordered deployment last month of 300 U.S. military personnel to Nigeria's neighboring state, Cameroon, to provide training and intelligence support to African troops fighting the terrorists. The United States supports our African partners in fighting Boko Haram by providing advisors, intelligence, training, logistical support, and equipment. The United States, wrote Kirby, will continue to support the governments and people of the Lake Chad Basin region in their ongoing struggle to defeat Boko Haram.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Next, on Straight Talk Africa, Pope Francis travels to Africa. Making his first trip to the continent, the pontiff will visit Kenya, Uganda, and the Central African Republic in a pilgrimage that will bring him face to face with Islamic extremism and Christian-Muslim violence. Join host Shaka Sali and his guests as they discuss the significance of the Pope's mission next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC on VOA Africa.